This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country, and we join their calls for justice.
Merry Christmas, everyone!
Ho, ho, ho!
Merry Christmas, Emerald Moon.
Not allowed to say that.
Happy non-denominational holidays, etc.
I think you're probably more likely to not be able to say happy Festivus, given how deeply cancelled Jerry Seinfeld is now.
Yeah, I know. Oh, that one's... I mean, I knew his politics. I knew already,
well,
but...
Well, it's not the
he's
politics.
He's going over there.
I mean, it's... Well, it's that, and it's the whole pedophilia thing. I think that's also...
Well, yes, that was also an issue, I suppose.
Yeah.
I will not accept. I saw some people saying, Jerry Seinfeld has never been funny. I'm like, come on.
I agree with... Yeah, come when people on. Like... That's a classic thing that people do now. They're like, they learn something bad about them. They're like... I always thought they were funny.
Yeah.
Bullshit. Everyone knows Seinfeld's a bit funny.
A little bit funny. Mm. I wanted to kick this episode off with a story. This is from a few weeks ago. This is from the start of December, but we just haven't had a chance to cover it as the journalists that we are, and I think we really should because it's really important and funny. Okay?
Okay. Yeah.
Do you remember Victorian Senator David Vann?
How could I forget?
This is the guy who in November 2021, there were claims that he made growling and dog noises at Senator Jackie Lambie as she spoke during question time.
Sounds like a great guy. Yeah.
Good guy. He apologized for interjecting, denied that he made growling noises though.
Okay.
He rejected that characterization, I suppose. In June of this year, he was accused by Lydia Thorpe and Amanda Stoker of sexual misconduct. He denied all the allegations, but Dutton did expel him from the Liberal Party. And so he moved to the crossbench. He was no longer in the Liberal Party.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this story came through a few weeks ago. We haven't talked about it, and I'm just interested in your thoughts.
Okay.
Senator Sixpack, David Vann used official Instagram to chat up women. To chat up women. Sorry, I'm gay. I can't say that.
Yeah, you don't. So chatting up women is when you're attracted to a woman.
What?
And you want to speak to her to, like, let her know and maybe get her to sleep with you.
That's weird. Makes sense? You freaks.
Yeah.
The former Liberal senator, being accorded by Labor for his crossbench vote, used official email and Instagram accounts to flirt with women and pitch the services of his private PR business, leaked screenshots and email show. This masthead can reveal Senator David Vann's use of his official social media accounts.
I'm really sorry to interrupt you. Flirt with women and pitch the services of his private PR business. Like, at the same time? What? That's not a good way to flirt, but okay.
I don't know whether he was using that as like a neg or something. Mm. You're so ugly, you need a PR.
Like people who flirt on LinkedIn, which I've heard is a thing. But sorry, that's another topic for another time.
This masthead can reveal Senator David Vann's use of his official social media accounts to message women using terms like babe and hun raised alarm in then Prime Minister Scott Morrison's office in 2021, prompting senior government figures to counsel Vann to behave appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Babe and hun. So he's acting more like a 50-year-old woman messaging these women than someone who's trying to hit on them, surely.
Yes. Or a drag queen.
Yes.
Or twink of some kind.
Yeah.
Hey, babe.
Hey, babe.
In a message to a cooking influencer with 21,000 followers in 2021, Vann wrote, "Hey, darling, here is my Senate page. Appreciate it if you can push it hard to your friends, especially the shot of me in the shorts, and give it the hashtag Senator Sixpack."
This is what I do need someone to unpack for me, because I'm like, this is not hitting on her, right? Like, he's just being really thirsty for likes. He's not being thirsty for her.
I guess
it's such a weird thing to say. Or is it like if he points out this picture, then she will go and look at the picture and be turned on? Is that the idea?
I guess there's an element, there's a sexual nature to this and the idea of wanting to be known as Senator Sixpack and posting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that he posted images of himself and a shirt on to his own Instagram.
You've put the picture in here for me to peruse.
I have, yes.
Yeah, it's not my style. His arms aren't big enough, I feel. But, and I mean, is that a six-pack? I'm not sure. He's at some sort of resort thing. He's also clearly, he's put a dank filter over it, which is really, really ruining it. But
also he's bald. The real David Vann is bald, but he's wearing a cap there. I reckon he looks a little bit like George Michael in this particular shot. He's got kind of like a George Michael kind of vibe in this one.
Right.
But look, far be it for me to criticize anyone else's stomach. But as far as six packs go, that is the most like entry level six pack. Like it's just tipped over to something that you might potentially describe as a six pack.
We've spoken about Nick D'Amato of the Katter MP in Queensland, right?
Remind me, is he the Hoon guy?
I think he is the Hoon guy, yeah. If like we may have spoken about his Instagram before on the show, but folks can just go check out Nick D'Amato on Instagram for a real, you know, real bod. Hashtag, I don't know.
Oh, he's ripped?
Oh, yeah. I think he used to be a bodybuilder.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, 6 days later, he messaged the same woman, the cooking influencer, "Hey, Doll, can you put a comment on that post of mine with the hashtag SenatorSixpack?"
Hey, Doll, so again.
He went back 6 days later.
Doll.
And is like, "David, Senator Sixpack is not a thing. Stop trying to make it
Stop
happen.
Stop trying to make yes. Wow. Oh,
in a separate private conversation on Instagram in 2020, a woman who wrote to Van, "You are a hot-looking man. Hee-hee, did you just have a stalk of my profile?"
Because he's obviously gone through and liked a bunch, surely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Although he says, "Not a stalk, was just trying to follow you back."
No, that's not. No.
Call me if you like, and I will see if I can help.
Help with what? Look, I mean, we love a senator that proactively offers support to his constituents. Slay.
The Greens get way too good a run in the Australian media, way too free a run.
Oh, dear me. Imagine being excited to see Adam Band. What is wrong with these people?
We're stuck with the hosts of Chapo Shithouse podcast.
This is a serious danger to Australia.
All right, let's do a show.
Okay.
Let's talk about the news and politics.
What is this? What show are we doing?
Oh, I think it's called Serious Danger.
Is it an official Greens Party podcast?
Nope.
Ah, and yet it's about Green politics in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never going to understand this. It's made possible with the help of the Green Institute and produced by Michael LeGriff Griffin, though, right?
I believe so. I can confirm.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'm back.
Hashtag Griff Sixpack.
Hashtag Griff Sixpack. Mm-hmm. Let's get it trending, dolls, darlings, huns, and babes. It's Christmas Eve, a very lovely time for not many people, I actually think. And so we're checking in on some lovely stories like Anastasia Palaszczuk's resignation from Parliament because Tom insists that as a Queenslander I should have something to say on this. So we'll see.
You have thoughts. You have takes.
But I don't really have any interesting ones. Well, no, I do. Sorry. Please keep listening to the show. I've got really interesting takes.
Fucking good hook.
I do. I've got insider information. And then we're talking about something that I feel like we've been wanting to talk about since the start of the defamation trial. This is the Bruce Lerman's defamation trial against Network 10 in relation to the story that they did with Brittany Higgins and her allegations that it emerged were against him.
A wonderful, lighthearted Christmas show.
Merry Christmas, everyone. Yeah.
How was your break? How was your time off?
It was good. I was away for a week. I actually shortened it. I was just by myself driving around Aotearoa, New Zealand. Mm. And it was, I'm glad I just did a week because I got a little bit bored by the end. But it's very beautiful. Well,
did you go see Chloe Swarbrick, friend of the show?
Well, she's on the North Island. I was on the South Island.
Oh, okay.
So no.
next time.
Next time, yeah. She was busy. Don't know.
Well, thanks very much again to Lila RPG for filling in for me when I was away. Yes. And big thanks to Steph Hodgins-May for co-hosting Emma was away last week. We appreciate it. And thanks, as always, to our wonderful patrons. Thanks to Elizabeth, who signed up to support us at patreon.com/seriousdangerau this week. You can support this show, become a patron for just $3 a month. You get bonus contents every fortnight. We released a Patreon episode this week on intergenerational warfare, millennials v boomers. We finally solved it once and for all.
Tom's representing
and interrogated as to what am I.
Yeah. Ironically, Tom's representing millennials and I'm representing boomers, I think.
You're very pro-boomer. That was a really great conversation, so if you want to listen to that, plus the whole back catalogue, just go to Patreon to support the show. Before we dive into our topics, I thought we'd give a really quick update on the rental inquiry report that was handed down. We discussed this on the show, of course, a lot with Max and some other folks. This is the first ever National Senate inquiry into the rental crisis that the Greens secured earlier this year.
As part of the HAF negotiations, as people like to say. negotiations.
That's right. We got the inquiry out of that,
I'm pretty
that
sure.
particular period, right?
I mean, it's probably the government wouldn't say that it was part of that, but I feel like it was one of the concessions. Yes.
It was conducted by the Community Affairs Reference Committee, which is chaired by Green Senator Janet Rice. You got Maureen Fruki and Penny Ormond Payne on that committee as well, plus some other losers from the other parties. We were encouraging people to make their submissions too. I made a submission to the inquiry. Share your experience as a renter. You made a submission as well. Apparently, there were 16,500 submissions, which, according to Max Chandler-Mather, makes it one of the biggest inquiries in Australian history. That is a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess there was a simplified way to make a submission, and in the report, it constantly says this simplified submission process, which seems like a kind of a dig. A little
that
bit like,
is. That is,
oh,
isn't it?
Oh, we got lots of for a simplified process, but who gives
whatever.
Well, the committee's final report was handed down last week, and so we thought we'd just run through it very quickly. It's not going to make you happy, dear Serious Dangerousness, I'm afraid.
It didn't fix everything.
It was titled The Worsening Rental Crisis in Australia. They had an interim report a few months ago, but this final one was focused on that, looking at the experience of renters, rental affordability, rent controls, and renters' rights. And as Max Chandler-Mather summed it up in an email he sent out to supporters this week, unfortunately, after reading the submissions and hearing the testimonies of thousands of renters across the country, Labor has once again chosen unlimited rental increases and to prioritise the profits of the property industry and banks.
Well, that's true. So, but does that refer to the government's response to the report itself, or is the report not good? Because the report isn't Labor, in theory. Was the report any good? Did the report have any good recommendations?
Well, I assume, presumably Max is referencing the comments from the Labor senators on the committee. And so basically, the report basically lays out, here's what we heard as a committee when conducting this inquiry. And then there's a summary. And of course, Janet, as the chair, she summarizes and says, recommends we should do the Greens policies. The coalition summarize and say, no, that's wrong. We shouldn't do any of that. And it's
policies.
All about supply. Yeah. And the Labor goes, they're going, we're doing really well. And this is a great endorsement of what the Albanese Labor government is doing when it comes to housing.
So good. Love these processes.
Very quickly, some highlights that I think will make you particularly angry. I'll be interested in your thoughts here, Emerald.
Okay.
A number of rental property owners and their representatives argue that meeting the accommodation needs of all sectors of society should not be seen as a function or responsibility of the private rental market. For instance, the Real Estate Institute of Queensland submitted that the moral debate of whether all Australians are entitled to secure housing is justified. There's a debate about that.
The debate is justified. Okay.
However, it is unreasonable to expect private investors to place themselves in financial hardship in order to house others at their cost. Respectfully, we do not consider it the responsibility of private investors to provide social housing in Australia. That responsibility lies with the government. Now,
Tom,
I think that's interesting.
They're right.
But doesn't that go against all the bullshit landlord propaganda that they care about?
It contradicts everything else that they say, that it is their responsibility and that's why they do it. Fuck, they're so fucking... How can they just say that and not be like, oh, this is going to directly contradict everything else we say? Anyway.
We love providing housing except to poor people. You guys do that. But also don't tax me more so that you can do that. That would be too bad. You just figure out some other way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
On measures like increasing Commonwealth rent assistance, job seeker, and the housing and the HAF itself, basically the report sort of says, oh, all the submissions like welcomed these things that the government is doing, but everyone agrees that it's nowhere near enough and it's dog shit and it's like not going to fix the rental or housing crisis in this country at all whatsoever. So that's helpful, I guess.
Yeah.
The spicy stuff, of course, is about rent controls and questions about rent caps and rent freezes. Throughout the inquiry, some participants suggested various forms of rent control to regulate the price of rent and alleviate the financial burden on renters. However, other participants also noted that some options for rent control may have unintended consequences, including potentially reducing rental supply and increasing homelessness.
Oh, my God.
Treasury and the DSS, the Department of Social Services, argued that rent controls could lead to a reduction in the number of rental properties, drive up market rents, and create rental market inefficiencies. So you had the Treasury Department and the Department of Social Services submitting evidence that, you know, they say, like, we can't do any of this. It's going to be terrible. It's going to hurt people more than help them.
Yeah. Go back and listen to, well, if anyone didn't listen to our episodes debunking this nonsense about rent freeze and rent caps, go back and listen to that.
Yeah. The coalition particularly was shocked and concerned that the culture of home ownership is in decline. Coalition senators believe that home ownership should be at the centre of our response to this crisis. By revitalising the Australian dream of owning your own home, Australians will not be impacted by changes in the rental market. Demand on rentals will fall, and most importantly, people's hard-earned income will go to paying off their own mortgage and not someone else's. Okay, so they just hate renting generally.
It's an interesting, approach that they're taking. Because so did you know, I don't know if they've done this anywhere else, but in Queensland, one of the things that they've done ahead of the election is announce that they would have a minister for home ownership.
Right.
But it's clearly like a framing that they're taking.
Yes, there's one in Victoria too. The Liberal Party has a shadow minister, shadow minister for home ownership.
And I don't know, I initially was like, well, I just don't know if anyone sees that as a possibility, so would it really work? But it's true that the dream of owning your own home does persist, and people, I don't know. Maybe it's...
Yes, but they think it's mindset, okay? So Coalition senators were shocked to hear evidence from Tenants Victoria who claimed that the dream of home ownership in Australia was transitioning away to a life of renting. They also cite an opinion piece from Daniel Andrews who basically just said lots of young people aren't as invested in the idea of home ownership anymore. They're accepting or just seeing the reality of society and thinking, well, I guess I'm going to be renting for a long time. And so the Coalition senators write, while it may be part of Labor and the Greens' ideology to force young people into becoming perpetual renters, it is the Coalition who has ambitions to make every Australian a homeowner if they want to be a homeowner. We utterly reject any cultural shift away from home ownership and recommend all parties do more to revitalize the Australian dream of owning your own home. So it's just we just need to dream harder, guys.
Let's make housing a culture war somehow. God, the Liberal Party sucks.
But it's there's no material conditions. People aren't maybe owning your own home does kind of suck. It's like, no, it's I can't afford a fucking house, so of course I'm going to be renting. And of course, the Labor senators endorsed policies. They wanted immediate resistance for renters that don't make the problem worse. A significant focus of this committee has been examining the calls from stakeholders for the introduction of rent controls, particularly temporary rent freeze on rents, followed by regulation to cap rental increases. Labor senators acknowledged there was a wide range of views for and against rental control measures presented to the committee. On the balance of the evidence provided to the committee from housing policy experts, Labor senators are of the view that the potential unintended consequences of implementing a strict rent freeze and additional rent control measures are too great a risk to bear and could ultimately make things worse for those they seek to help.
And who exactly do they seek to help? Who do you seek to help? Labor senators. Just curious.
The intended consequences of making landlords slightly less rich and helping renters not fucking end up homeless. That's a real concern. So as I say, Greens say, let's do Greens policies. You could have written the conclusions of all these senators before you had this inquiry, in my opinion, my particular view. What is the fucking point? I mean, I know a couple of weeks ago you were talking about this inquiry the Greens have now got into supermarket price gouging. I don't know. I just read it as all very depressing. And
well, I do think that Labor MPs, when they're facing election, would look at the fact that there were 16,500 submissions on this and a huge groundswell in support for renters' rights and rent controls. And just think about that a little bit when they're heading to an election. I think the more, as we've said, I think in the past, it creates a platform to demonstrate that there is a growing social movement in support of this particular thing, and that increases pressure on primarily Labor.
People can read the report for themselves if they'd like to. We'll put the link in the show notes. Sorry, one last thing, and I did really want to put this to you because this really made me laugh.
Yes.
This is from the Coalition senators. Coalition senators are concerned that mere conjecture over the Greens' rent caps or freezes has been enough to spook mum and dad investors into increasing their rents in preparation, artificially increasing the market cost or exiting the market altogether, which diminishes supply. Both these things exacerbate the crisis, and as our recommendation, they're ruled out so that market confidence is returned. We can't even talk about freezes and rent caps because it scares the mums and dads.
Yeah. They're so scared. And where do the houses go?
Thanks, Senate. Appreciate it.
It's so familiar. It's like it's been buried in my head for years.
Carl, what is it?
I found the exact same notes.
It's a laugh. It's a puppet.
They giggle in everyone's head. That wee chap's about to change the world. Imagine what he would say.
All right, Tom, What do you know about Stephen Miles?
Old Giggles himself. Is that his name?
You know the Giggles nickname.
Well, I saw it in the notes here, but I have heard that before. Oh. Yes, I have heard that
before. You have heard that? Where from?
Just in general coverage of Queensland politics. Yeah, maybe on Twitter.
Okay.
Once or twice. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I think he's an incredible media performer. His charisma on camera just really speaks to me, and I think this guy is okay. Electric.
For a second, I thought you were being serious.
He knows what he's talking about. I'm so glad he's leading the Sunshine State.
You got me good. Well, Stephen Giggles Miles is the new Premier of Queensland. You're right. He's kind of known, like, I guess Giggles comes from the fact that he always looks like he is about to laugh whenever he's speaking, like at a press conference, whether it's about COVID, whatever the fuck it is. He looks like he's about to laugh. It's the same when he gives speeches. And sometimes he does. He just does a little giggle. He has this little kind of impish smile that could almost be charming, but, I mean, when you hate him, just pisses you off.
He did. The last time I saw him on TV, he did 7:30 report talking about the floods in northern Queensland, and he was very reserved, as you solemn? Would expect him to be, and solemn.
Right.
Yes, and I reckon probably most political leaders, I would say, broadly speaking, when talking about a natural disaster, or are just there to basically provide a basic overview information about what their government is doing about a particular crisis. You know, they generally come across as like vaguely okay. Like he didn't seem across the basic details,
yeah.
But he did seem quite nervous, I would say.
Interesting. I mean, I want to talk about, the disaster response, because that's been kind of like the first test of his leadership because he was sworn in this week, right? It's so last week while I was away was when Palaszczuk resigned. Where were you when you heard the news, Tom?
Where was I? What day? That was on the weekend, wasn't it?
I think it was. Yeah, it would have been. Probably the Sunday?
Yeah. I would have been recovering from the Meredith Music Festival.
Ah.
Yes.
Cute. Yeah. Well, I had this, like, I felt like I was in another universe because there were multiple hours delay between this happening and me hearing it, and I didn't get a single news alert about it on my phone, which spun me the fuck out because I was just lounging back on a little chair by Lake Tekapo. on my holiday, and I got an alert from the Courier Mail that was like analysis inside the Premier's shock resignation speech, and I was like, her what now?
what? Shiga Wina?
Sorry,
because there had been rumblings, right, particularly from child journalist Leah Polisi at Six News, that there were
rumblings when.
Well, I just saw them tweeting about organizing numbers, like people were trying to pull the numbers and like trying to find a challenger. And before we actually got the news that she was stepping down.
Yeah. Right. Because, I mean, that's the rumblings have been happening for at least the last year, potentially more.
Yeah.
Like, for me, I've got so sick of hearing about whether Palaszczuk is going to resign. Mm. And every time that you speak to a journalist or anyone in Queensland politics, they're like, do you think she'll stay? Do you think she'll go? Oh, she's got to go, blah, blah, blah. But I was actually, honestly, I didn't expect this. I was like, nope, they're going to stick with her. And if they were going to get rid of her, I thought it would have happened much sooner. And they really, like, they just kept responding and saying, nope, she's staying, she's staying, she's staying. Mm. Even, I don't know if you saw this, but like a few months ago, everyone was like, oh, she must be staying, because they released this ad that was like this very shiny, expensive, you know, Queensland election ad effectively that really centered Palaszczuk and her voice. It's like, Queensland is great. I'm Anastasia, like, I was born in blah. I did this. I want to stick with you.
I grew up in Durack. My grandfather came to Queensland as a migrant. He was a boilermaker. He said to me it was tough work, but it was a job that put food on the table and a roof over his head.
There's a part where she's like, you know,
our plans work, and I'm determined to see them through. If you know me, you know I don't give in, no matter what.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And then not so much.
She did not.
So
in fact,
you would
stick
say
with it.
We assume that she resigned because if she didn't do that, she'd be rolled by her own party.
Oh, I suppose so, yeah. Like, it seemed like she wanted to stay, potentially. I really thought she was going to, and it must have all happened pretty quickly because she gives this resignation speech at this random, at a press conference that was actually meant to be, I think, about Tropical Cyclone Jasper.
Right.
And apparently there was maybe one or two Queensland politics reporters in the room because it was just this random weekend morning press conference that obviously no one was expecting this. Then she was like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm quitting, guys. And then within a few days, it emerges that, yeah, there were two contenders to replace her, one being Shannon Fentiman and one being Stephen Miles. Do you know Shannon Fentiman? Like when I say Shannon Fentiman, interesting. But you knew who Stephen Miles was.
Is she in health?
She is now, but only recently. She was the Attorney General before that.
Oh, right.
And, like, I mean, she would be a much better leader in my view, but it's true. Like, she's less well-known because Miles was health during COVID, right? And, I mean, he's Deputy Premier. He has, yeah.
Deputy Premier. Yeah, okay, right. Yeah. Now, and they're both on the left of the party, in theory?
Yes. And so, I mean, I don't know how interesting it is to get into this. Like, there's been a lot of chat about the behind-the-scenes factional deals and wrangling and union kind of pressure and all of that to get Miles to eventually get the support of the party to be the leader. Mm. But, yeah, as I understand it, like they're both on the left and so it kind of then hinged on getting support from the right, if that makes sense, and so right unions like the AWU and it's kind of unclear, at least to me, I don't know if there's more information, you know, from what I've read, I don't quite understand what, if anything, the AWU might have got in exchange for backing Miles over Fentiman. Right. But there's a whole lot of union stuff going on in the background. And I guess when you're talking about the rumblings that were happening in the lead up, it seems like for at least maybe a few months before or that like a little bit beforehand, there's been, yes, a behind the scenes campaign to get the party ready to roll Palaszczuk and replace her by the United Workers Union. And in particular, President Gary Bullock, apparently, and he's been saying, you know, having all these conversations with power brokers and people like Jackie Trad, former member of South Brisbane, lost her seat to the Greens. Kate Jones also resigned.
Wait, Jackie Trad's still involved? What the hell is she doing?
Well, apparently she, although actually, sorry, I should say, I don't know if she was involved in these conversations. It was more that she liked a post by Shannon. She like backed in Shannon Fentiman. She liked a post by Shannon Fentiman being like, I'm going to contest the leadership. And so they were like, interesting, Trad's backing Fentiman. So, you know, kiss of death. But Kate Jones, who's
Hey, Jackie, yeah. Can you unlike that post? Can you actually distance
maybe
yourself?
Maybe, that's right. Kate Jones, who was, I don't know if anyone remembers, kind of a former rising star in Queensland Labor, and she resigned ahead of the last state election. She was in Cooper, which now may fall to the Greens, fingers crossed. And mm-hmm. she was apparently involved in this kind of behind-the-scenes push. So it's very Labor. Okay.
And the broader political context is state election next year.
Mm.
Polling, unpopular, long government, you got a real fight on your hands. It would.
Oh, yeah. I guess I should zoom out.
A strong belief that Labor will have to pull out something special in order to get another re-election at this point.
Yeah. So the election is in October next year. Labor is very much slipping in the polls. Palaszczuk is unpopular. I would say there definitely has been a very concerted News Corp campaign to paint the picture of Palaszczuk as an unpopular premier. I think it's been successful. I think it's true. People really don't like her. She comes across as like super arrogant. She's got that name, the accidental premier, because no one really expected them to win when she became premier, and then she stayed on all this time and, you know, led Queensland through COVID, was likely one of the big reasons that they won last time in 2020. But now,
2020, right.
Yes.
Right. So in that time, even though she was very, very popular at the time of the last election, particularly for the state's approach,
people are just over it now.
Or at least certainly approach to borders and stuff, Queensland hospitals over Queensland, et cetera. That was quite a popular strategy at the time. But since then, her popularity has waned.
Yeah. They literally, on the polling booths in 2020, the Labor volunteers were all saying, stick with Stasia, stick with Stasia. Like it was all about Anastasia Palaszczuk. Now she is poisoned, which is why I think everyone expected them to dump her sooner. But I suppose, I don't know, the year out, it's as good a time as any. I don't know if this will help though. Do you like how do you think people view a political party changing its leadership? If she is so unpopular, do you think people are really going to be like, oh, they got rid of her, so maybe I'll consider them now? I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, does your average voter care too much about the backroom dealing? Because if they're across this news at all, the first impression you get is, well, it was her choice. She's decided to resign. She's resigning from politics as well. She's stepping down from She's resigning as the member for Inala as well.
She's leaving politics. Yeah.
So she's leaving politics completely. How many terms? Three terms?
Yeah, must be.
She'll have three terms all up. So, you know, at least if you're not following politics that closely, you'd be like, oh, she's called it. She's resigned. Daniel Andrews just did the same thing too. He just won an election. So I don't know whether they'd perceive it as the Labor Party getting rid of her. And in fact, the Labor Party can, I assume, be like, hey, thanks, Anastasia. Thanks for everything. Off you go. It can be nice and clean, as opposed to an actual leadership role if she didn't actually want to leave, which all gets very public and messy, particularly as you're going into an election year.
I mean, I think that surely the average person would see it as, the Labor Party making a decision to get rid of Palaszczuk because they see that she's unpopular. Whether that satisfies them, I think, is another question. And it is like, I do think that surely people find, we know, right, that people find all the leadership changes frustrating, annoying, particularly, when they've happened at a federal level. And to have members and ministers stand up time and time again and be like, nope, we're sticking with Anastasia. This is the way it's going to be. When, like, they're lying. There's a clip. There's this story from a few months ago when Palaszczuk was in Italy, and this was the whole thing. The Courier Mail was like, "She's in Europe. Oh my god!"
Oh yeah.
And Stephen Miles was the acting premier, and Shannon Fenderman joined him at this, press event, and there was all this speculation, like, these are the two potential people to replace Palaszczuk. Going back and watching that is very funny in retrospect, because, Stephen Miles stands up and he's like,
"The Premier is determined to lead our United team to the election next year, and I've got no doubt that's what will happen.
The Premier continues to deliver with the whole of the team."
It's like, ooh.
I guess, but it provides cover. If it was reported widely as Anastasia Palaszczuk resigns, right, because that is what happened. It comes on the back of the same thing happening in WA and Victoria. There is at least a relatively believable cover story that, like, she's called it, she's off. And, whereas, if you're following politics relatively closely or even just casually, you'd say, okay, she saw the writing on the wall and decided to cut her losses and get out.
Yeah. And then I guess the question is, so it's like, if people are like, oh, Palaszczuk's just left and, Miles is replacing her, but whether that would actually have an impact on the election outcome and what people think of Labor, I think that they've seen a slight boost. Like, I think that since her leaving and being replaced by Miles, people have liked it a little bit. But is it really enough if Labor just keeps being Labor? But what is interesting is I mean, he is clearly trying to communicate this idea that he is going to be different. Like, he's trying to differentiate himself from Palaszczuk as leader. He's trying to say that he's the guy that's going to do the things that Palaszczuk wouldn't. And I
was like, Palaszczuk from the right?
Yes. Oh yes. She's from the right. Lot of the things, like a lot of the cooked things about Queensland, she did kind of have a reputation of being the problem, like the obstacle on key issues, like progressive issues. She has a reputation as being the reason that Queensland has taken such a cooked line on, youth justice, for example, and suspending the Human Rights Act and trying to lock up more children and build more child prisons. She, as well, like, she does not understand climate change, I think, until recently did not understand the difference between, an emissions target and a renewable energy target. Like, she literally she's very shit on those issues and everyone knows it. And with her out of the way, seriously, it's like, well, maybe Labor could be a little bit better. And Stephen Miles in particular has a reputation as a bit of a, as a progressive Labor MP, non-oxymoron.
You can't even say it.
I know.
Well, I know, particularly, and there's been a lot of focus about his focus on climate, right? I mean, so he does the Al Gore course in 2007 or whatever. He does the Al Gore
The Climate Reality thing. Project Leadership Program.
Right.
Whatever that is.
And he said that changed his life. And he has certainly, at least since taking over the job, laying out his ambitions to be more ambitious on the question of climate.
Yeah.
That's been certainly part of his pitch.
Yeah.
Is that good? Is there much to that? Should we be excited about that?
To be honest, so Queensland's emissions reduction target up until whatever last week when Miles took over was 30% by 2030. So on par with the former Morrison governments, which was 26 to 30% on 2005 levels by 2030. For context, the Greens policy is 75% by 2030, the net zero by 2035. Miles.
Also, the policy of the Climate Council as well. So
yes, yes.
Pull that out of our asses. That was actually based on the experts and stuff. The Climate Council that kind of almost immediately gave up on that account or pushing the government to reach that, even though that's what the science says. But anyway, that's where we pulled that particular target from.
Yeah. And so, but I think everyone knew, like post-federal election, everyone has been expecting the Queensland government to upgrade its emissions reduction targets. They release their energy and jobs plan, which has a bunch of better, you know, renewables commitments, like some pretty impressive stuff, which I think we spoke about on the show. But we knew the emissions reduction change was coming. I thought they would probably align it with the federal, which is what, 40-something pathetic, right? By 2030, like
43%. I can't even
remember anymore. 2043. Erased it from my
43%.
Mind. 43%. Well, Queensland Labor, Miles has come out with 75% by 2035. Like, that's kind of significant for Queensland in particular. Like, Queensland is a high emitting state. 75% by 2035 is significant, I think. It's obviously, no, it's not enough. It's not aligned with what the experts are saying, but it's almost close. The big problem is, of course, they continue to approve new coal and gas mines, and that will fuck over our entire globe, because that's not included in our domestic emissions reductions or emissions targets, etc., because it's going to be burnt overseas, so it doesn't count. That's the big question when it comes to climate. But it's a significant signal. And the other thing that Miles did, which I think maybe got less reporting, is like probably his last act as the planning minister before he moved into the premiership was to reject this Clive Palmer coal-fired power station. Kind of this technical reason that he could reject it as a planning minister. He had call-in powers. He'd called it in years ago. It actually had been sitting on his desk for years and years. The last day that he has to approve or reject it, he rejects it right before he moved, like right after he's announced that he's going to be the new premier, or we learn that he's going to be the new premier. So that's significant as well. Mm-hmm. Like, clearly, I mean, he's doing stuff.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, pitching a lot of this, like, you know, I want to be the premier for the city and the bush, and I want to work to bring rural and regional communities and help them with the transition, I suppose. So I guess in places like Gladstone and stuff, it seems like he's invested in that idea of, bringing communities with them and, helping them in that green transition as much as possible.
But, I mean, that's stuff that the government's already been doing with their energy and jobs plan, I would say. Like, I think him spruiking that, obviously, yes, is part of the new image that he's trying to paint. That's not new, though. Their energy and jobs plan actually has a bunch of good stuff around transitioning energy workers. What it doesn't have is anything around transitioning resources workers and as we stop approving fossil fuel projects. So that's the problem. But it's clearly them acknowledging that the Greens are a threat in Queensland. We know the Greens are a fucking threat in Queensland. Like, it is in every story about the state election in 2024 is how many seats are the Greens going to pick up? Are they going to be in the balance of power? How does this impact Labor in
Are they going to be allowed to sit in Parliament? These are the questions being asked.
Yes, that's right. Can we just kick them out? Is there some rule we can write that says they're not allowed?
Can we build a separate little Green Parliament that doesn't do anything?
Yeah, and they could just chat amongst themselves and care about things.
A Greens voice to Parliament, perhaps.
Climate, obviously, is an issue that's associated with the Greens. Another thing that the Greens have been campaigning on a lot is the 2032 Olympics, and in particular, the proposal to demolish and rebuild the Gabba Stadium at a cost of $2.7 billion fucking dollars.
Would
result in also the demolition of East Brisbane State School, the loss of that school completely for that community, loss of a local park, etc. Yeah. Deeply fucking unpopular, and the Greens have been going really hard on this. The other first thing that Miles does as the new premier is ditch the Olympics related portfolios. Anastasia Palaszczuk had created the like minister for the Olympics and Paralympics and made herself, she was that. His new cabinet doesn't have the Olympics portfolios. And he said, quote, we're going to pause on the projects. This is when asked about the Gabba redevelopment. We're just going to have a review. We're going to take our time to consider that. And we're going to set up an independent authority. So there are some moving parts that we're going to reflect on as a new government. Clearly trying to distance themselves from this project, right?
Yes. Love to see it.
It's so fucking blatant. This is a government that was like, oh my God, the Olympics is the best thing that's ever happened to us. They would not shut the fuck up about it. They created these new portfolios. And now they're like, seems like maybe people don't like this. Maybe people will vote for the Greens. don't like that. And they're distancing themselves from it. And it's not just Labor, though. I don't know if folks saw this as well, but the LNP mayor just like a couple of weeks ago, Adrian Schrinner, also resigned from the Olympics organizing committee over the Gabba redevelopment. Yes. And kind of, I think he's more like, oh, lack of transparency around it or whatever. But this is the council that is also facing a local government election in March of next year, where the Greens are tipped to pick up a bunch of seats. Like, are we seeing a pattern?
I did see a particular tweet about that decision. I believe from an account literally called ALP Shill,
says, love that one.
Oh, the two major parties are the same. That the broke take is the two major parties are the same. Woke, the Greens and the Coalition are the same, pointing to the fact, retweeting the story that the LNP mayor had stepped down. And shout out to Elizabeth Thompson, as always, friend of the show, who said the federal Labor government was the first level of government to pull out of supporting these projects or whatever. But, you know, go off, whatever you like.
It's political
now
poison.
It seems our Labor state government is sort of saying, oh, actually, maybe this is not good.
Because who the fuck thinks it's sensible to spend $2.7 billion knocking down and rebuilding a stadium for the Olympics in the middle of a cost of living crisis? Like anyone in Queensland is going to look at that and go, oh, maybe there are better things that could be spent on. It would be political poison. But like, I mean, it would be really interesting to see whether Labor actually ditches that project. Maybe they'll see how much in danger they are. I don't know. I'm sure they're weighing up their options, or whether they just make kind of noise about, oh, we're considering it, and then they do a review and they go, actually, we looked at it and we decided, or KPMG told us again that it's a good idea.
Yes, this independent review said it's actually good and we're great.
Yeah, Deloitte says, actually, the new stadium is good and we don't need state schools. Who knows? But yeah, I don't know, some interesting signalling of their priorities. I also think it's interesting, though, like things like moving the planning portfolio, they've given that to the housing minister, Megan Scanlon, which is clearly consistent with the way that Labor is approaching the housing crisis, which is just this thing of we just need to cut red tape and it's all about planning and new private development. That's going to solve the housing crisis. We just need to incentivize that. Yeah, yeah. What I do think is smart is they created a new ministry for disaster recovery. And I mean, this is what I think we flagged earlier. We've seen Cyclone Jasper like ravaging far north Queensland this past week. Cairns has, you know, really been suffering the effects of that. And that is what better test for a new premier than a natural disaster? And I think he's been doing pretty well. Like he's been in all the right places. It seems like people are fairly happy with the government response beyond, you know, people are always going to be like, why didn't we get warning sooner, all of this. But there certainly hasn't been, I think he's done about as well as he could have.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously I'm not saying that he would be grateful for this natural disaster, nor I think it's a good thing. But in terms of like a new leader, it is something of an opportunity to project leadership and strength, and it's sort of uncontroversial, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like people are just trying to help, and the government can do lots of things and the need is very clear and you can't get in too much trouble or take any kind of controversial view, because of course everyone agrees that we should support people who are facing the consequences of that natural disaster. So
yeah, that's right. Like it can be a very unifying moment for the state as well, which kind of like COVID, in those, you know, after those sorts of incidents, people can tend to vote towards incumbents.
Right.
So it's interesting. Right. I don't know if it's going to be enough to save Labor. Like the polls are pretty bad. People are pretty sick of it. They've been there for a long time. The LNP are shit. And I mean, do you know who the leader of the LNP is?
It's Chris Fully, right?
Yes. You're right. But I don't, like, he doesn't exactly have a significant profile. Like, okay. I mean, I don't think that people are really going to be like, oh, I really want to vote for David Crisafulli. I really want to vote for the LNP because of that leader. I want him to be the premier. People would be voting against Labor.
And what is the majority? How many seats do they got?
Oh, my God, I don't know, too many.
We've got two.
We've got two. Not enough.
52 out of the 93 in the...
Yeah.
Does that sound right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay.
Yeah. And then that's Labor. And then the, because we've got two, there's one Nation, three Katters, one Independent.
Right. Well, good luck to all involved. I mean, I think, yes, as we say, we'll talk about a lot in 2024, but Stephen Miles also has a reputation as a bit of an attack dog. As you say, he hates the Greens. No, look forward to them punching left as much as possible, and I guess trying to present their green credentials and their supposedly more progressive credentials to try and diminish the contributions of the likes of Michael and Amy and any new Greens candidates who are coming along.
Mm. Do you remember the drama of him allegedly calling Scott Morrison a cunt at the Labor Day rally? I'd forgotten about this until I was like, Stephen Miles moments. We talked about it, I think. I think we might have spoken about it on the show.
And what did he say? It was just a slip of the tongue.
It clearly was a slip of the tongue, but he'd said something about, you know, Scott Morrison being somewhere and that context, he says. And everyone, you know, the crowd kind of goes wild.
Yeah.
Albo's here with us at Labor Day, while Scott Morrison's charging $5,000 a head to have dinner with him. What a contrast. Don't we need contrast.
I understand I might have stuttered while speaking earlier and that someone in the crowd might have misheard what I said. I want to be very, very clear that I was using the word contrast.
All right.
I removed the festive hat.
I think that's probably appropriate, Tom, to approve the hat when we're talking about this. And I guess also before we get into talking about this defamation trial, it relates to an allegation of rape and sexual assault. So we're going to be talking about that stuff. So if that's something that you don't feel like is a good thing for you to be hearing about right now, maybe skip this last segment of the show. We'll love you anyway. We'll forgive you for it. Or you can give it a crack, and if at any point you feel like you need someone to talk to, you could call the National Sexual Assault Domestic Violence Counseling Service. It's 24 hours, that helpline. It's 1-800-RESPECT, and we'll put that in the show notes as well. So we're recording this on Friday, which is the final day of Bruce Lerman's defamation trial against Channel 10. I think this is the day that they do all their closing submissions and say they kind of sum up the case. And this is in relation to a segment on The Project that aired back in 2021 where Brittany Higgins alleged that she was raped in Parliament House. It didn't at the time name the accused, but Bruce Lerman is arguing that he was identifiable and that Channel 10 defamed him. So yes. I'm also going to try and do this without opening ourselves up to defamation proceedings and getting sued. So we'll be using the alleged.
Please do. We don't have enough patrons to cover a court case.
No.
And we don't want anyone to firebomb our houses either. So just
oh, God, watch yeah. it. All right. Yeah. Fuck, that was crazy. Have you followed the Bruce Lerman, Brittany Higgins stuff much?
Well, yeah, it's been unavoidable. I mean, and it has obviously been going for a very long time. The original case, the movement, the resurgence of the Me Too movement, particularly focused on the culture within Parliament, was a very big deal. And yes, the initial case that got up that then fell apart, which seemed like an absolute shit show. And maybe this is all in your summary you're about to jump into. But I mean, yes, it's been everywhere, and we haven't really touched on it in the show. A for like you know cautious legal reasons. B, because I think the political take, I suppose, is hard to discern or where we sort of land or what else can we contribute to it. There is so much noise around this and so much commentary and so much fucking gross evidence of rape culture left, right, and center, particularly in the right-wing media. So I've been very nervous and I'm very glad that you're doing it.
Well, I think, but I guess that's the thing. I have to admit that I haven't followed this story very closely, really only recently when I started seeing news about the defamation trial and kind of seeing evidence that's coming out as part of that, did I go to look at the actual story? I honestly didn't really know what the story was. I feel like I've maybe consciously tuned it out a little bit, and it's probably because, I think that some of the political, what's the word, things that people have taken out of it, I don't necessarily agree with, or I'm not necessarily interested in those and like this hyper focus on this one particular case. But I mean, it makes sense that this case got a lot of attention because it is salacious and it is really fucked. And I guess, for anyone who isn't across the kind of detail, like I wasn't, a really brief summary, basically. So in 2021, this former Liberal staffer Brittany Higgins did this interview. It came out with news.com.au, but the big one is she did an interview with The Project saying that she was raped at Parliament House. She didn't name the rapist at the time, but ultimately he was identified as, the alleged rapist was identified as Liberal staffer Bruce Lerman. They were both working for Linda Reynolds. That happened in about August, so a few months later, before he faced court where he pled not guilty. He denies the allegations. What Brittany alleged was that her and Lerman and a bunch of other staffers were at a bar in Canberra. She says things like that he was being handsy. There's kind of reports about maybe there was a kiss, maybe there wasn't. Brittany says that they ended up at Parliament after someone suggested they share an Uber home because they lived in a similar direction. Lerman has varying stories for why they ended up at Parliament, why he took them to Parliament. At some points he said it was to continue drinking, like to go and drink whiskey. Sometimes he says it was to go and get documents, sometimes to get his keys. Higgins says that she remembers Lerman getting them through security, and people might have seen this, like the CCTV footage of her, like with her shoes off going through security. You know, security officer said things like, oh, they didn't realize she was drunk until she struggled to put her shoes back on, things like that. She says that she was very drunk, that she woke up on a couch in Linda Reynolds' office to Lerman on top of her having sex with her. She says that, yes, so then Lerman left without Higgins, and security found her either naked or partly undressed. It's unclear. On that couch, she was offered an ambulance. And, you know, what followed after that is also kind of the, you know, subject of conjecture, where she then brought it to varying people in varying kind of ways. And there's a question as to whether she was pressured to, or she felt pressure not to make it, you know, a really kind of significant allegation of rape or sexual assault, whether she was pressured to kind of leave Canberra, go and work on the Gold Coast or WA, things like that. But yes, so she had, I think, not proceeded with the complaint, but after the story with the project, she recommenced the investigation with the AFP, and he went to court. In the meantime, before the trial had started, this story became a key prompt for those March for Justice rallies. Brittany had that iconic kind of speech at one of these rallies at Parliament House in Canberra. There was also, I think, the other iconic moment was the following year where she did the NPC address with Grace Tame. But the trial at the end of that year ultimately ended up in a mistrial because one of the jurors admitted that they'd gone and like done their own research. They'd sought external information, which the judge had said again and again and again, please do not do that. You can only rely on the evidence that's offered in the case. They did it anyway. It was a mistrial. It was going to go back for a retrial. But before that happened, Higgins said that she was going to drop the charges. And her lawyers said that it was because basically it was an unacceptable risk to her health to continue with the charges. I think she was potentially hospitalized at the time or around that period of time. So the criminal trial ended up not happening effectively. There's no conclusion. Bruce Lerman wasn't found guilty. But he then went on and sued News Corp, Channel 10, and the ABC for defamation relating to this. The ABC was for that National Press Club address. News Corp was for that original article. And then Channel 10 is for the project interview with Brittany Higgins. He eventually settled with News Corp for $295,000, which I believe is meant to just be like legal fees. Like it's not damage. It's just $295,000 fucking dollars. He settled with the ABC for $150,000 he got from them. The defamation trial against Channel 10, though, has gone to trial because they did not settle. And that is what has been happening for the last month or so. Other, I guess, context that hasn't been reported, you know, a lot in connection to the defamation trial because I suppose maybe it's not, you know, not necessarily relevant, but I think is interesting context is that following these changes in Queensland to the law around identifying people accused of sexual assault, Lerman was also identified as someone who has been accused of raping another woman in Toowoomba 2 years ago. So that matter is still in the early stages. It hasn't been committed to stand trial, but he's also accused of another sexual assault against a different woman. So defamation trial has been going on this month. It's almost finished. And the thing is that this trial then acts as almost like a de facto criminal trial in a way, because that criminal trial ended in a mistrial. This is now going over the facts of the case in order to establish whether what the project recorded was like meets the defense of truth criteria. Right.
Which again, and you know, I don't mean to laugh because that was very serious and horrible, but I mean, one cannot help but be reminded of the Ben Robert Smith case in which he brings a defamation trial and then basically gets owned in court as more and more details are brought out. And in the Lerman case, my impression is he's changing story, the lies that he's told.
Yeah.
You know, he's not coming out of this exactly dirt free. And yeah. So it does seem very debatable as to whether he's going to be successful here. But
anyway. Yeah, I think that's right. Like some of the things that have come out throughout the trial. And I guess what's worth noting as well, what's interesting about the defamation trial is that the judge made a decision to live stream it on YouTube, which is unusual. And there's this interesting quote by Parnell Palm McGuinness in the Sydney Morning Herald, who says that the criminal prosecution of Lerman had been widely referred to as, quote, trial by media, because Higgins had gone to Network 10 to air her allegations publicly. Now, they say, it's the media on trial, which I think is kind of, it is interesting because it's looking at both whether Channel 10, you know, fairly reported it or whether they defamed Bruce Lerman, but it's also giving the public the opportunity to compare what bits the media decides to report and how they report them with the raw footage of the whole trial. Like they can go and see everything that's come out and compare that to, yeah, what the media decides to pick out. So I think that is interesting.
Interesting. Well, do we know the reasoning for live streaming on YouTube?
I think he was just saying that, like, it's a matter of significant public interest and importance, and so people should have access.
You've got Brittany Higgins testifying about her rape, don't you? Like, isn't that?
But I think
maybe
that
are they closing some parts of it at least, or I don't know.
I think some parts were closed,
right.
But I mean, I also think that Brittany Higgins has, you know, at a number of points where some people might not have decided to testify themselves or like to appear in the courtroom itself, for example, she's done that because she, you know, is committed to, I guess, telling her story and has had to do so again and again and again. Pretty fucking brave of her, I think. Pretty incredible to have been dragged through the mud as she has and to keep doing that. But yeah, meanwhile, some of the things that have come out is Lerman was being cross-examined and it came out that he has been paid. He's done these two exclusive interviews with Channel 7 about the case. They paid his rent for a year. He received 12 months of paid accommodation from 7 at $4,000 a fortnight. They've put him up in a beachside apartment complex with an in-ground pool and spa and, quote, amazing water and coastal views in Sydney's northern beaches. So that's worth $104,000. So cool, Channel 7, that's really awesome.
Wonderful stuff.
Other things about the actual events of that night.
Sorry, just imagine being a Channel 7 employee. Maybe like you're negotiating your contract or you're organising. You're like, we don't have any money to give you a pay raise. Really? Giving shitloads of money to Ben Robert Smith and Bruce Lambert.
Yeah, I know. And I think Brittany Higgins said, you know, outside court, at one point during this, like Channel 7 asked her a question. She's like, aren't you paying his rent? Because can you imagine? I mean, anyway, stuff about the night itself. There's one thing I thought was interesting, but perhaps that got me to click on this was like they got a lip reader in who analyzed CCTV footage at the bar and testified things about basically Lerman encouraging Brittany Higgins to drink more. Like there's this whole table of drinks and the lip reader says that he says, drink all of that now. And she's sort of saying like, I don't want to. But the lip reader is saying he's really plying her with drinks. And there's another staffer who had testified that they were furious at Lerman for pressuring Higgins to drink more. They like swore at him. This is something that we've now seen all this evidence about. There's also evidence about Higgins telling multiple people about the alleged rape. So other staffers that she'd messaged about it. There's a Queensland LNP member, Sam O'Connor, who says that he texted her about it and then called and said that she had been raped. He said he remembered that. And then it's in the later stages turned to this obstruction allegation, like whether there were attempts from within the coalition or even a culture within the coalition that would have prohibited or prevented Brittany Higgins from reporting this and treating it the way that it was kind of should have been treated, I suppose, because of the political fallout or because of the impact that it might have had on her job.
And Linda Reynolds and Michaela Cash, they would argue that it was up to Brittany Higgins, right? Like they gave her the option, and initially, at least, there was a period in which Brittany Higgins did not seem to want to go to the police about this particular.
Yeah, so there's this whole thing where I think the chief of staff, Linda Reynolds, chief of staff at the time, was forced to like compelled to give evidence, and she says that she felt actually pressure from above to report what Brittany Higgins had told her to police, but that she felt that was more about people covering their asses, effectively covering themselves, than concern for Higgins. And yeah, she was like, oh, I felt like it was up to Higgins to report it. Yes. I don't know. Yeah, like they're what people are more interested in here, or what's more important, is it like, how did something like this come to happen? What are the conditions brought more broadly in, like, in a society that lead to something like this allegedly happening, or even culturally within the workplace of Parliament, or who knew what when and how they responded to it? And maybe it's all kind of the same thing.
Well, it's been a sort of a feature of the Me Too movement and Me Too stories over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, right? The, as you say, the salacious details about certain incidents and sex gossip and stuff, which people have been attracted to and are somewhat naturally prone to discussing, right? There is a level of scandal there in which you want to know all the weird, freaky details about what, how fucked up Harvey Weinstein is, et cetera, et cetera. But I suppose also the attempt by progressive and left-wing people to think about these things structurally and to actually, you know, critique them in a political, structural way so that you can, you know, stop these kind of things from happening. I mean, the initial Higgins revelations, yes, started this whole conversation about the work conditions of Parliament, yeah. But what was very rarely missing from that conversation was how unionized are these staffers? How much power do their bosses have over them? Like, you know, what should we... What are our labor laws like that would actually prevent these kind of things happen or provide disincentives for people to exploit and abuse their co-workers or their employees from a boss-worker relationship? That's what's always seems to have been missing in this stuff from my point of view.
Yeah, because apparently, so the project story, like Higgins' story came out after there was this Four Corners report about, I think it was called the Canberra bubble, that was about a toxic workplace culture in Parliament, and particularly talked about like inappropriate relationships within the coalition. And there had been previous reviews into, I guess, that, I think that a lot of, sorry, I should say, the March for Justice was calling for recommendations of previous like sex discrimination and harassment reviews to be implemented. But it was only after the Higgins allegations that the Jenkins report, which as it's commonly known, because it was held by the then Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins, she led it, but it was the Independent Review into Commonwealth Parliamentary Workplaces, or Set the Standard. The Jenkins report was conducted, surveyed hundreds of people who work in Parliament House, got all of these, you know, fucked up statistics, like apparently 33% of the people surveyed who worked there experienced some form of sexual harassment. Which a third, like that is pretty significant. And it's, yeah, like I have heard from so many people who work in Canberra, in Australian Parliament, that it is like a fucked up, there's just a culture of, you know, drinking and I guess a lot of people working late, there's so much pressure. And it's the fact, I think as well, like what might differentiate it from say Queensland Parliament or State Parliament is everyone is staying there and they're just like away from their family, away from everything for a week. But yeah, like how do you fix a culture like that? I mean, I guess the Jenkins report has 28 recommendations that are now the government's committed to implement. They have introduced this bill for like an agency that would advise MPs and their staff on sexual assault and misconduct allegations. They have delayed another one of the recommendations, which is the actual kind of enforcement body for that. So the Independent Parliamentary Standards Commission to investigate complaints and then sanction reps.
At the moment it's under the Department of Finance or something fucked up, right?
Yes, that yeah. Maybe that's right. Yeah, there's no actual kind of independent body set up for this.
Do you have a sexual harassment complaint? Well, come talk to us at the Department of Finance. Yeah. We need help.
As if you fucking would. Yeah. But it's like, but I mean, yeah, I don't know. And I haven't read the Jenkins report. Maybe it probably does talk about how though, when you set up these bodies, how do you make people believe that if they make a complaint and go through those processes, it's not going to affect their job because there's, you know, Brittany Higgins had said in these original interviews with news.com.au that she chose not to make a formal complaint. She said that was driven by her desire at the time to protect the Liberal Party and her, quote, dream job on the eve of the election. She said, it was just about my job. If it had happened on a street corner away from Parliament, there was no doubt in my mind, of course, that, you know, she would have reported it. But she was really young. She was what, I think 24 when this happened. And yeah, felt that it would have affected her job. And I think, yes, it's about her position, right? And probably also the position of the party that you care about, the political project that you care about, and that she would know that an allegation like this would have impacts on the Liberal Party's prospects, probably.
Yeah, and there's, you know, some pretty good critiques about the roles of staffers generally. I mean, there was a piece, we could put a link in the show notes too, a Bernard Keane piece, just about basically about political staffers generally, just sort of, and he sort of lists all the scandal, Bruce Lemon being the obvious example of like, who are these people? Why do we need them exactly? Because they're not quite public servants. They're sort of beholden to the party.
I think they're right.
Yes, well, you're the one good one. But there's some pretty good critiques about just their position and how much power, if you're working directly for a minister, how much that minister controls over. You're not like a full-time employee in federal parliament. Like they both would have been employed by the Liberal Party?
No. I don't think so. They would have been employed by parliament.
They're employed by parliament to work there. Okay, yeah. Anyway, the power relationships in terms of reporting and that kind of thing. Yes, but clearly in these kind of incidents, people need someone else to go to, someone who's not an impartial body, an independent body that's going to be on their side. And they should also be members of their union, and their union should fight hard for workers' rights when it comes to sexual harassment, of course,
yeah.
too, which lots of other unions do a very good job of, and should be stronger and should be able to represent their workers in these kind of cases, for sure.
But I think you're right as well that it does come down to, I mean, everything that we were talking about in the whole Me Too era and that we continue to talk about, which is about rape culture, and that really what needs to change is the factors that led to this being allowed to happen. Like, even it looks like people did kind of push back on her being, I guess, pushed into, or allegedly pushed into, drinking so much when she maybe didn't want to, but probably, yeah, I don't know, like that someone didn't say maybe you shouldn't take her home or wherever you're going. Maybe they shouldn't share a cab. I mean, maybe people assumed that she would just get home safely with him. Who knows? But people kind of knew that he'd expressed that she was good looking and things like that, but maybe someone should have called it out then. There are multiple points that someone could have stepped in, you know, security when she couldn't put her shoes back on. Maybe that should have rung alarm bells. But people not wanting to, I guess, make a fuss or do something uncomfortable to prevent something like this potentially happening, and not wanting to call out this kind of behavior. And the fact that, yeah, there are then people who will pay someone accused of rape like this hundreds of thousands of dollars in rent to get a story or, you know, defend them again and again, whether it's this case or another. I mean, all of that culturally, like, that is, I think, contributing to this. And yeah, in high pressure environments like parliament, where there's all these other kind of political factors, it's heightened. But yeah, of all fucking places, like, this should be a place where there would be people to step in and call this out way before it got to that.
Yeah. My last question on this is, did you see the video of Bruce Lemon singing Bruce Fought the Law and the War won?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Bruce won. I fought the law and Bruce won. Bruce won.
I mean, this came out in November. It's apparently filmed in October 2023 on the NRL Grand Final weekend when Mr. Lemon stayed with friends at a holiday rental on the Central Coast. There is no suggestion of any illicit drug use on this holiday, according to this news.com.au article.
Why'd you say
that? I will say
there's a
plate placed in a certain way in the shot that raises one's claim. And Lemon has talked about how he turned to cocaine and spiraled on the night the project interview with Brittany Higgins aired, telling mates, "Need bags." Once that went to air, that was his response to the allegation going out. But yes, he's singing along to this song, and it's "I Fought the Law" and "Bruce Won." It's quite difficult to watch. And
well, we'll see the outcome of him fighting the law this time.
Yes,
stay tuned.
We will. And then I believe Brittany Higgins could look forward to being sued by Linda Reynolds as well. I think there's a defamation case coming against her and her partner David Shiraz as well. That's also
awesome. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Like, and who wouldn't make up an allegation like this when they know what's in store for them, right? It looks like so much fun.
It looks awesome.
So
yeah.
much in it for you.
Oh, God.
Everything's gonna be cool this Christmas.
Everything's gonna be cool this Christmas.
Everything's gonna be cool this Christmas.
All right, Christmas call to action. What are we telling people to do on their break, Emerald? What homework are we giving them?
Not too much. If you want and you're at a holiday event with your family and someone says something cooked, you might like to respond in a way that maybe encourages them to think about their actions and their things that they're saying and rethink their assumptions. The Greens have a cheat sheet, but I think you should check out the Greens, what is it called? Guide to Bullshit Conversations with Your Relatives or something like that. We'll put the link in the show notes. But Tom is giggling because he has another one in the ABC.
The ABC one's lame. I mean, this is just Greens talking points, by the way. It's just like if one of your relatives says
the Greens one
Labor has ended the climate wars, then you can give them the facts. Or we just can't fix the rental crisis, and then you can give them all the facts. So there's a little guide there. Yeah.
It's good to have reminders, though. Or you could just play them excerpts from the Serious Danger podcast.
You certainly can, indeed.
Shh. And then hold your phone up.
This podcast is recorded. Well, the ABC posted one too, like this classic article on ABC Every Day. It's like, you know, four ways to diffuse awkward conversations this Christmas. And they talk to these experts, apparently, about the things you can say to relatives if they say something cooked. Miss Hutsey's four phrases for dealing with rude comments are, what an odd thing to say out loud. I'm surprised you feel comfortable saying that. Did you mean to share that with the group? Would you mind repeating that?
Wow.
That's a good one.
But she's saying that they work because they're sassy.
Yeah, she says these sassy responses can help bring a bit of humour to a situation, which works well for some family dynamics. If you know, at Ballard Family Christmas, there's witty repartee all over the place, people shooting each other down.
Right.
We're all vaguely online with politics, that's not an issue. Psychologist Carly Dover says an alternative is to go straight to redirecting the conversation. If someone says something that offends you, you can always just say, yep, moving on. What do you think about the football?
What does that mean? This is someone who's never had a conversation about football in their life. What do you think about the football?
Football, yes or no?
What do you mean?
Merry Christmas.
So, what do you think about the football, Tom? For or against?
I'm against it myself, but that's just me. Now, let's talk about the Greens' policies on the Stage 3 tax cuts. Shut up, Tom.
Anyway, yeah, you don't have to do any of those things if you want. Our call to action is have a rest.
Treat yourself. You can always rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening. Hit us up on social media at SeriousDangerAU on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Email us anytime you like. hello@seriousdangerpod.com. We will have one more episode before the end of 2023. It will come out on New Year's Eve, and then we'll be ready for a big old 2024, baby.
We recommend timing it so that, you know, it drops right at the stroke of midnight. That's the best way, best thing to listen to.
Brilliant.
Start your new year right.
Bye, everyone. Merry Christmas.
Bye.
Oh, I'll put the hat back on. Hang on.
Oh, God.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
I have one. This is serious danger to Australia.